Hello, it's time for another episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. I'm Rob Wolf, and I have the honor of being your host, although the real honor is that I get to talk with authors about the things they love to do most, which is write. Probably one of the things they like to do least is talk about their books, since writers tend to be notoriously shy, but maybe that's not the case in Sweden. So why do I mention Sweden? Well, because a couple months ago, a man named Peter Oberg sent me a copy of a collection of short stories by Swedish authors in English that he edited. And since I'm always interested in how science fiction and fantasy is imagined through the lens of other cultures, I invited two of the authors in the collection on today's show. With me, through the miracle of voice over IP, are two contributors to the collection, waiting for the machines to fall asleep. They are writers Anna Jakobsson-Lundt and Oskar Schellner. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. And you actually managed to pronounce my name correctly. I'm impressed.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I have to say, I'm very appreciative that we're doing the interview in English. I'm always self-conscious as an English speaker that quite often, you know, people learn my language, but I have not learned theirs. So thank you for both writing in English, your short stories, and for speaking with me in English.
No, thank you for having us. It's really great to be given this opportunity to speak a bit about the book. I think I don't fall into the category of people being uninterested or shy of speaking about their book. I think it's lovely to be able to speak about my writing. It's like, try stop me.
Oh, great. Excellent, then. Well, then we'll have a very rich discussion. That's a great way to begin. So why don't you both tell me a little bit about yourselves and your writing careers, and then we can talk about the story collection. So, Anna, do you want to start?
Yeah, I can start. Well, I work as a political scientist, and I help people organize their companies and work with their policies and a lot of bureaucratical, boring things, and as my day job. And then I've been writing since I was little, actually, and mostly realistic pieces. When I published my first novel a couple of years ago, it was a really realistic, quite traditional Swedish story, kind of dark and bleak, and people sitting in rooms not talking. And then,
That says a lot about Swedish culture, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, I think it's a really Swedish book, and I'm also from the country. In Sweden, we don't call it the countryside. I'm actually from a small town, but I live in this vast nothingness of people living really sparsely apart. So I think that is in my soul as well. This kind of dark and I think isolated ideas about people and life and everything, and I think that is that was interesting to write, and I was thinking that I would continue writing realistically for the rest of my life. But then I kind of stumbled into writing science fiction. I always read it, and I always read fantasy, and I like it, and I like the stories, but I didn't think I had it in me to create the worlds and do the storytelling. I always thought I was more of a people sitting in small rooms not talking to each other kind of writer. So I was kind of actually surprised with myself when I found that I was writing science fiction and that I really liked it, and that more and more stories, short stories, came out of me that were all set in different alternative universes. And I think that I'm not turning back to the realistic stories. I'm done with the people not talking, and now I actually have some scenes of people not talking to each other in my science fiction books as well, but still, it's in a more interesting environment than my hometown. So I think I'm sticking with the fantastic stories for now.
And Oskar, what about you? You've been writing since the beginning, I think. Haven't you writing science fiction and horror? Although I think you got a relatively late start as a writer. I read that somewhere in an interview you gave.
Well, actually, I have written fantasy, horror, and science fiction. And as you say, I am not the kind of person who has always been writing. A lot of my author friends are. They always tell stories about how they wrote their first book, well, so-called book, when they were like 8 years old and so on. But I did not. It was somewhere when I was around 27, 28. Well, because even though I really didn't write so much when I grew up. I have always made up stories in my mind, always played with my own universes. And I got my education, if you will, from the classics. When I was around 9, I discovered Jules Verne, and I read pretty much everything by this old Frenchman. And I was fascinated by his stories, how he could write about submarines 50 to 60 years before they actually existed, who he could write about traveling to the moon like 100 years before it happened, and so on. Then I read quite a lot of Isaac Asimov. Actually, it was my mother, who is also a science fiction fan. She put the Steel Caves by Isaac Asimov into my hands when I was around 11. And then I read everything, just everything I could find by Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, and Arthur C. Clarke. Those three great Golden Age authors. And then it just continued. So I differ, I guess, from Anna in that respect that I have always found so-called realistic literature a bit boring. the fantastic, especially when it comes to science fiction, has always been the kind of literature to grab me and hold my attention. But I do love fantasy and horror as well. Actually, my two first books were fantasy. I had, as I said, I started to write when I was around 27, and I'm 36 now, so it's been a 9-year road trip this far into this undiscovered country.
And do you have a day job as well?
Well, yeah, I am a software engineer otherwise. So I usually write on the train back and forth from work. I get 45 minutes of writing done there and 45 minutes back. So after a while, if you're disciplined, it starts to pile up.
Yeah, very efficient use of your time.
Well, it's actually the only time I have, so I have to be efficient. But it actually works. It's something about trains and the sound they make. And you sit down, open your laptop, and suddenly I'm in the zone. So it works perfectly. I do write sometimes during nights and so on when the kids and the family is asleep, but I never really get into the zone as quick as I do on the train. So, yeah, it's something about trains, you know.
And the authors you mentioned as inspiration, I mean, you mentioned Jules Verne, who is French, and then you mentioned three American authors.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not familiar with Swedish literature. I mean, I've read, you know, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I'm sure I've read some other things along the way, Pippi Longstocking and such.
Yeah, yeah.
But is there a tradition of science fiction in Sweden as such?
There is a tradition, but it's quite small, unfortunately. There is a much larger tradition when it comes to fairy tales and fantasy. For example, you mentioned Pippi Longstocking, and Astrid Lindgren, who wrote those stories, also wrote the Brothers Lionheart, Mio Mil Mio, and what's that called in English? Ronja, the Robber's Daughter, I think it's called in English. And those are definitely fantasy. Even though most Swedish people who read them as kids or got them read to them as kids, I don't really know if they understand that it's fantasy. I think they just think about it as fairy tales. But we have a strong tradition when it comes to that. So that is also why my first two books were fantasy, and I mixed in quite a lot of the old Swedish fairy tales, old Scandinavian mythology, the Norse gods and stuff like that, trolls, elves, etc. Because in that way I was able to write a fantasy using my own culture's heritage and not live in the shadow of Tolkien or other Anglo-Saxon, more Anglo-Saxon literature. Not that there is anything wrong with it. I love Tolkien. Tolkien was also one of those authors that made his mark on me when I was around 12. But still, it's interesting and fascinating to be able to create something new from your own cultural heritage.
That's a good lead-in, I think, to the short story collection that you both contributed to. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how the collection came about. It's called Waiting for the Machines to Fall Asleep, and it's billed as a collection of new Swedish voices in science fiction, although it was written in English. So maybe Anna or, I mean, Oscar, either one of you want to tell how you got involved in the project?
I think that the collection is actually quite telling of how the science fiction scene is in Sweden today. Because, as Oscar said, there's no big science fiction scene. And I think that the fantasy scene, we all, as readers, tend to think of fantasy as tales for kids. We all read the fantasy stories when we were kids. And we also have, I think, a lot of readers read the big Anglo-Saxons, like Tolkien, when they're kids, quite early on. We have people are highly educated, and a lot of our parents read the stories and then passed them on to us. But I think that the big publishing houses tend to think that this is something that stops with young adults. This is nothing for adults, and it's not there's not any status for a writer to be writing science fiction or fantasy. There's a trend, but I think we tend to look at it as a trend that will pass. The big publishing houses see that this is the Harry Potter, the Hunger Games. It's for kids, and it's a trend, and there's not even a genre of it in Sweden.
No, they don't actually get it, unfortunately. I do believe, however, that Game of Thrones is starting to change that. The TV series has been a huge success here in Sweden, just as all around the world, it seems. So possibly they are starting to catch up, but, well, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of independent editors and publishers that are of another kind, that love fantasy and science fiction and do this out of some passion. That's not, for them, it's not a trend. It's the only thing they read. It's the only thing they live for. And the publisher that's done this collection is one of those. He just collects stories and publishes new short stories by unknown authors all the time, and I think that says something about the scene in Sweden today.
It has happened a lot on the Swedish scene during just the last 5 to 6 years, with the advent of cheap printing and ebooks, etc. There has been hundreds, no, not hundreds, but there has been a lot of new small print publishers with passion, as Anna says, who wants to get genre literature out there in new ways that the big old houses don't think about doing or don't dare doing. Well, it can be a mix of both. But so suddenly, just the last 3, 4, 5 years, it has been almost like an explosion of new fantasy, science fiction, and horror. And I do believe that this anthology, Waiting for the Machines to Fall Asleep, is in a way a kind of proof of that. It's kind of a distillation, you could say, of a lot of these new talents who has been showing up on the scene. Well, there are some older talents in here as well. Some of the old guard is here as well. But quite a lot of the authors in the anthology are the new ones who has come now with the new small print publishers.
And why was the decision made to publish in English?
Did you ever talk to Peter about that? Because you've been on the scene longer than me, Oscar. And you know Peter.
I spoke to Peter about it. And, well, Peter, he's one of those passionate people who is behind one of those new small print presses. And, well, in just a couple of years, he has managed to build up his affront publishing from just a small publishing house to something which has actually managed to make an impact on the scene, a real impact. He has published quite a number now of anthologies in Swedish, and people have started to take notice. There has even been reviews in Dagens Nyheter, which is the biggest daily newspaper here in Sweden. So something is definitely happening. And when I spoke to him, I believe that he thinks that it's time for the Swedish scene and the Swedish authors to reach a bigger audience. If you look at it in pure numbers, what is it? We have like 10 million speaking Swedish in the world.
I think it's like
something like 10 million. And how many English speaking or English reading people are there out there? I don't know. A billion? Two? Three?
Yeah,
I don't
know. Then. All of Sweden and Swedish speaking Finland is like London. So I think it's. We're a small language, and it's a big world out there, and I think that Peter's doing the right thing, trying to get the stories.
But these stories are not in translation, where they did, I assume, or maybe I'm actually not clear. Did you write them originally in English, or did you both write in Swedish and then translate them yourself?
I think there's no translated stories, professionally translated. Everything is written in English, and I think that most of the stories are written in English for this.
I actually wrote mine in Swedish first. I tried a bit in English, but I realized that my width of vocabulary wasn't really that good enough, and then I translated it, and then I let a friend of mine who is an indigenous English speaker proofread it. Because there is, you see, in Sweden, we hear English all the time on television, we read it all the time on the internet, but it's not that often that we actually get a chance to sit down and speak like we're doing right now. It's been quite some time since I did it last time, and it's not very often we actually write in, well, at least not very often I write in English. So I had to do the extra step and actually translate it.
And why don't we talk a little bit about the stories and the subject of these stories in general? I mean, they cover a broad range. I mean, there's kind of a space opera, there's fantasy elements, goblins. I think there are 24 stories in the collection. Oscar, your story features a woman who's traveled through space and has been a adventurer in space, and I guess due to the laws of relativity, you know, has returned to Earth relatively young compared to the husband she left behind, and they meet, and it's a love story as well. And Anna, yours is a little more set in a dystopic setting and literally messianic in a way, because the protagonist holds out the hope for, you know, society's renewal. So I don't know if you both want to maybe talk a little bit about your stories, why you chose those themes, and if there's anything uniquely Swedish about them or if they're really universal.
You start, Oscar, because when I start, we can't stop me. So,
all right, then. Actually, I wrote this for a German anthology, which seems to never get out. So when Peter asked me if I had anything in English, I sent this to him, and he liked it enough to bring it on into his anthology. When I thought about Germans, what do Germans like about Sweden? They like our classic red cottages with white trimming. Let's put a story in a red cottage somewhere out in the country. And, that sounds kind of lame, but that's actually how it started. But then I wanted, usually I try to mix existential questions with pretty fast action. That perhaps sounds a bit strange, but that is, in a way, my hallmark. I like to mix up philosophical questions about life and death and love, etc., and gun-toting people running around screaming. But this time I skipped the guns and the screaming and just tried to go for this relationship between this man and this woman. Honestly, I don't remember anymore where I got the first idea to the story, but I wanted to see if I could cram down as much emotion and as much powerful dialogue as possible in as short space as possible, if you understand what I mean. So I needed two people who were really angry at each other, but who were still drawn to each other. So I thought about this couple, two people who really loved each other, who had something going, something beautiful. But relationships are never easy, and something came between them, and suddenly she got this offer to go on the first interstellar expedition to see other suns and other planets. And, well, who could say no to such an offer? But it's not very easy to meet the people again, which you have left behind. And they are not really in a very good place when it starts. But at the same time, I didn't want to write a story with no hope. There are quite a lot of those stories otherwise, especially in Sweden. So I still wanted to be some kind of light and some kind of promise at the end of a new beginning.
I guess that's the challenge of a short story, is to pack a lot into a short space. And after quite a few years apart, this couple certainly had a lot to talk about.
Yeah, they did. He was quite angry, which was quite fun to write, actually. Anger is a powerful emotion. And especially since anger, in my opinion, cannot exist really without some kind of love, or that you care somewhere. Because if you do not love anymore, it doesn't really matter. So his anger and his... Well, it's quite understandable, in my opinion. And it's also been quite interesting to see the reception this story has gone. Well, there are some people who take his side, and there are some people who take her side. And it's very fun and interesting to see why and how.
Oh, that is interesting. It is. And I was going to note that he wears his wedding ring, which after so many years is a telling, you know, obviously a sign of his continued commitment. Anna, why don't we talk a little bit about your short story? It's called Messiah. And actually, I don't think we said what your story was called, Oscar. One Last Kiss Goodbye.
Exactly.
And Anna's story is Messiah. And it's set in a very kind of grim, dystopic vision of the future, which from an American perspective, I think we've tended, at least historically, to look at Scandinavia as kind of the ideal balanced society where everyone's taken care of and everyone gets along.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of dissonant, and even though I know that's never probably been 100% true, and maybe less so today, just as things are changing in the world. But talk a little bit about your story, where the idea came from and what you were communicating.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I read a lot of Oscar's stories, and he's, as he said, he's most often there's fighting and there's philosophy intermixed. And in this story that he wrote, he's actually done the two people sitting in the woods talking or not talking. So he's, you're going down my alley, Oscar, and you better stop because it's not a fun alley. Now you've been there, now you can turn away.
It's still science fiction in a way, so.
Yeah, you put out the interstellar thing, but you really, deep down, your Swedish soul is speaking to you and writing these. I see this the Izzard sketch where he's saying that British films are like this, rearranging matches. It's a lovely bit, and it's like we don't talk to each other, and you have to watch yourself, Oscar, because you're going down the wrong road there, and
you do know the power of the dark side.
Yeah, because I wrote my first novel, I wrote that for like 15 years, working on it and working on it and working on it, and it was all realistic and dark and the people just sitting, doing nothing, eating hard bread. And because I've done that, I'm not doing it again, and not even for a selection of stories that maybe if you think about it, you can say, what do we want to show? What are the Swedish perspective on the world that we, when you write in English, you want to show something, you want to write in a tradition or something. And I think my short stories are, I'm actually working on a longer trilogy now with a novel that's out this spring and then another coming out this autumn and another next year, and it's eating my time and it's eating my energy, and it's really a lovely thing to be doing, but it drains me a bit. So when I do the short stories, it's like my little breathing holes of just making up a world just for this story. The story is perhaps 8 to 10 pages, and the world doesn't have to hold up for more than 8 to 10 pages. I don't have to have a society behind it. I don't have to know how people vote or if there's been a war or even if there's the world is on this planet or another planet or in another time or space or something. So I think that for me, my short stories tend to be a bit to display some world building. I think that is a fun thing to be doing. I think because I'm quite new at having to build worlds, I tend to like it a lot. I do that with my stories, and I like that I, in short stories, don't have to build a big world. I can just keep it small and exact. And for me, the Messiah story actually started like a grain in a thought a couple of years back, where I thought about a person coming home from partying and a crazy person in the next apartment and they having a conversation. This was in my people standing in rooms talking to each other face, so this was all realistic. This was a person coming home from a perfectly normal Swedish party and with a perfectly normal Swedish lunatic in the apartment next to her. So it was... It wasn't a fantastic story. But then when I got this call from Peter that maybe I wanted to be in this collection, this story, first of all, it was called Messias in Swedish, and that was just an ugly word. It's not a good word. Messiah is a better word. So I was thinking about, well, maybe this Messiah story, if I call it Messiah, then I can do something with it. It's like...
What did the other word mean, though? Did it mean something?
It's still Messias is still Messiah in English. It's like just the Swedish version of it. It's like we're not a particularly religious people, and the word Messias sounded a bit too big, and it sounded not natural. I couldn't build it into the story in a good way in Swedish. So then when I started doing it in English, it just... Sometimes it is like that. You don't know. The language change makes you something kind of fits when you shift your language. And I think that was something I did. I tried out because I knew that I was writing my story in English originally, and I knew that this will be a struggle for me because, well, I'm mostly character driven and mostly language driven. I'm always struggling with the story. The storytelling part of me is weakest. I always have to struggle with that. But the language and the character is stronger. So then doing it in like with one hand tied behind my back, I knew that I had to struggle. And then I thought maybe I'll try something new. I'll try a language that feels a bit new and fresh and with a new take on it. Maybe I use a bit more adjectives than I usually allow myself. Because as a Swedish writer, you're kind of, I don't know, you kind of whip yourself into submission sometimes. You scale away and you take things off and you do things a bit minimalistic. It's not just the furniture, it's like the language as well. And I write in that tradition with always taking away, taking away, taking away. So then I thought, maybe if I shift language, I can do something else. Maybe I can call it the rickety bridge. I don't have to find another way to just say it and lose the adjective. So I was playing around with the language, I think. And then the story with this person saving the world, I was struggling to make it hold as a story because I had this person walking through this world where things were starting, in my imagination, things were starting to burn, and I was feeling this words coming like demi-kings of human waste. That was a good thing. She's walking here and she's just on her way to something, and what will happen? Oscar and me are quite the opposite. I'm just writing and hoping that somehow my fantastic story will just come to a fantastic end and everything will work out logically, and they never do, and I just cry and go over it from the beginning, and Oscar is more structured and I don't think he's crying as much, so I think I had that problem.
And I am a so-called architect, and you are more like a explorer, right?
Yeah, explorer. That's a fun way to put it. It's not so fun when you're there and you're lost, and it's like heart of darkness.
While I almost always know the end of my story before I even start to write it.
I was going to say you're front-loading the effort, though, Oscar. It must take you a while to craft the architecture.
Yeah, sure, absolutely, absolutely.
So you just do all the work up front, and then you have to. Then it's easier to write.
Yeah, long walks with the kids in the forest. Quite a lot of time to think about story structure. So often I do my at least my short novels. I have them almost structured 100% before I sit down and write them. Then of course sometimes you find new interesting angles, and then you let it grow organically, but still I always have the end goal, the payoff at the end in mind, so I always know in which direction I'm writing.
Well, so I wonder, is there something distinctly Swedish about this collection and about your writing? Well, so I wonder what that is, because on the surface, you could look at both your stories and say, you know, it has kind of universal qualities to them about the conundrum of the theory of relativity and traveling in space and how that changes the speed with which you age. And then on a story, a kind of grim future where that maybe there's some hope of salvation through this mechanism. I don't want to ruin the story, but there is, you know, something revealed at the end where it seems like this person has an opportunity to like go back and try again to make the world, to spare the world this disastrous future.
It has been quite interesting to see the reviews of the anthology, because almost everyone, almost all of them, point out how dark it is. And to be totally honest, when I read through it the first time, I didn't consider it overly dark. So it must be a Swedish thing, and that is also quite interesting, because as you said before, it is true that Sweden is, what did you say, a stable...
Well, it's always been, I mean, historically, I think Americans have looked to, at least more liberal-minded Americans have looked towards as an example of a society that has achieved balance, you know, has figured out how to live properly.
Well, yeah, and honestly, in my opinion, that is true. It is very good to be a Swede. We have full health care, we have... free education all the way up to university level, and anyone who has a talent can pretty much become anything. So there are no boundaries to make a so-called class journey. Of course, we do have our problems. Of course, every society do. But still, Sweden is a... Well, I am a Swede, of course, so I might be a bit... what would you say? A bit
biased.
Biased, exactly. In this, but Sweden, in my opinion, is a great country to live in. So the question is really, why do we write so dark stories when we actually live in such a bright country? I do have a theory on that, but I know Anna, you also have a theory, right?
Yeah, but we discussed this, and I don't know. I don't. My theory kind of crumbles. I think I look at my story and most of my other stories, and I think they're actually less dark than most contemporary Swedish realistic writers, because we have this tendency to write about divorce and problems. And I tell my friend that writes youth novels with a lot of love that you need some salt in the chocolate, baby. And she's like, oh, she's not that fond of the salt. She just wants to write the lovey-dovey stuff. But I keep telling her that you need some problems. And of course, I guess I get that from the the Swedish side of always looking at the world a bit hopeless. But the scientific stuff and the science fiction novels, they always have a bit of hope. In my story, the world is fucked up, but there's hope for change. But in a realistic story, maybe there's not as many problems, but there's no need to have hope in the end of that story. So I don't think it's that dark. I think maybe there's the storytelling that we don't shy away from the darker sides. I think we proud ourselves with being a bit braver with, maybe not with violence, but with other things. I think we see the Anglo-Saxon, maybe I'm speaking just for myself now, but I see the Anglo-Saxon literature and I think, well, here's a tradition that maybe sometimes think a bit more about what goes, what you can sell and how you should maybe not be so dark and not so much about how reality is or how to tell a story that you can really feel in your heart. So I think maybe the storytelling is a bit blunt and a bit, well, straightforward with the dark sides. And why that is, I don't know.
It is certainly true when it comes to Swedish crime. It's also quite interesting to notice the success during the last 10 to 15 years of Scandinavian crime novels.
Yeah, for sure.
Like for example, the girl with the dragon tattoo and such novels. I have heard that you can even walk into bookstores pretty much all around the world and find a shelf with a sign that actually says Scandinavian crime novels.
Yeah, I've seen that. And it is interesting because, as you say, you know, you have these wonderful qualities in your culture, and yet what you are also famous for are these kind of bleak crime kinds of stories. I wonder what explains that.
Well, let's take my theory then. I think it has a lot to do with our history, actually, because Sweden today is a very rich country. It's good to live here. But if you go back in time, just 2, 3, 4 generations, you know, during the 19th century, half of the Swedish population emigrated to America in the hope of a better life, because people were starving here. It was quite a bit of hell to live here, actually. It was so hard that there are... It is a saying that in the county where I grew up, it's called Småland, which means little countries. it is a county known for the hard people and the hard earth that they had to toil in to get their food. And it is said, I don't know if it's true, but it is said that they had 100 words for... honestly, I don't think that there is a straight English translation even for this word. In Swedish, it's orka. In English, it would be having the energy to be able to. And if you do not orka, then you can't take it anymore. And these people, it is said that they had 100 words, different kinds of nuances, talking about this, how they just couldn't take it anymore, or how they just had to find energy to go on. And this kind of living, of course, leaves a mental mark, a subconscious mental mark, if you will, in the entire culture. So even today, 3, 4 generations later, when we have industries and computers, and we are a high-tech country, etc., there is still... something of this melancholy, this sorrow, this sadness, which lies in the back of our, well, of our stories, our songs, even in our nursery rhymes. We have a lot of bleak material, if you say so, to get stuff from when we write. And when it comes to Swedish crimes, since we are... And I always smile a bit when I say this, when I speak to Americans. Since we are a socialist country,
you smile because it's not exactly true, or just because it's provocative to say that?
I smile because it's not exactly true, but it is true at the same time. Well, you know, when I watched the first election when Barack Obama got elected, I actually followed that quite a bit over the internet, and there was an interview with his vice president, and the interviewer asked, "Is it true that Barack Obama wants to transform America into a socialist country like Sweden?"
Right.
It was quite fun to hear Sweden taking up as a horrible example of socialism. But let's get back to the crime novels. I think that there is also in this Swedish version of socialism, which is a mix between capitalism and socialism, that there is a will and a passion to expose wrongdoings in society, to find the dark corners and shine a light in there, to expose it so that we can do something about it. And so I believe that there are lots of Swedish crime writers who has actually taken it upon themselves to find these areas and shine some light into the darkness.
We comment on society. I think that our resistance, our history of resistance is always almost as strong and as old as our history of poverty. So I think that is something that we pride ourselves of. And then when we show society, of course we show a darker and more bleak kind of society, because we don't do the crimes or any kind of stories in parts of society that are functioning. I think that is something I put into my writing, and I think it's most science fiction writers all across the globe, but most always in Sweden, where we have this tradition of resistance and of shining the light on wrongdoings. I think we use science fiction as a way to say something about society, and a society that we see could be something more, that we see could excel and lead. Because for Swedes, I think we live in a great society where people, most of us, are fairly safe, and we have a lot of security, but we also have a lot of outlook, because we are a small country. You can't live your own whole life in Sweden and just speak to Swedes, because that would be incredibly boring. It's not like our country is not a continent like the US, so we have a lot of we see a lot about the world, and the world is not a safe place. The world is not a place that is living up to the potential of mankind. And I think that is something that leaks into us as well, because we have a lot of traditions about that, looking at the world and seeing that it could be better.
But you've also had, you have your own issues, as I understand, like immigration, although you're still one of the more open nations, I think, in Europe. Yep. But things have been changing all around Europe. So I wonder how some current issues might be affecting the consciousness of writers and the stories that you tell. And even when you say it's safe, you know, I do remember when your Prime Minister, Olaf Palme, is that his name? That was a major news event that I was aware of, because I was so shocked that the Prime Minister could stroll home with his wife from a movie theater with, I think, if he didn't have bodyguards. And I'm sure things have changed since then, but
of course we have our problems. Sweden is by no in no way an utopia, and perhaps that is also why we still put so much darkness into our stories, because as Anna said, there are always things. I think that I believe that the struggle for society and the struggle for civilization is a struggle that every generation has to do for itself. You cannot live on the old blessings of generations who has gone before without you also adding your part to the flow of culture, to the flow of society into the future. If a generation slacks off and believes that they can just take it easy and live of the blessings of which older generations so hard has fought and so forth, they will wake up, I believe, to a horrible surprise. Isn't it an English expression to say that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance? And I believe it's true.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about self-publishing, because I know you've both experimented with that, and that's kind of exploded here in the United States, and I imagine all over the world, at least where the technology is available. And so I wondered if you could share a little bit about what the state of traditional publishing is in Sweden right now, and what your experience with self-publishing has been like. Anna, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think that we've seen a couple of maybe 5-6 years now. Things are starting to happening. It's because it's a small language. We can't just, if you're an Anglo-Saxon in any way, you can just publish your story on Amazon, and then you have it for a bigger audience. But we have to sort of create our own market, and I think that's happening now. That we have a lot of the big publishers. I think they are waking up to the notion that people are taking their stories elsewhere, because we traditionally we don't have, we have a few big publishers, and they do their own, they have their own, well, they can only take on so many authors, and they have their own traditions, and in those traditions I don't think that science fiction and fantasy actually exist more than like a few stories each year for
very few
if you look at the whole picture. They tend to, if you have a great story like The Hunger Games and you know it's going to be a big movie, then why don't take it and translate it and go with that story instead of looking for the great science fiction story of from a Swedish writer.
And also, if they do publish a science fiction story, they don't call it science fiction. They call it something else in the hope of reaching a larger market.
Yeah, so I think in that context, it's growing, the self-publishing. It's something that's easy to do, and it's we have a lot of people that have experience. And I think that one upside of being a small community, like 9.5, maybe 10 million people speak Swedish and live in Sweden, and then the upside is that there's a community, a rather tight-knit community of people wanting to share experiences, that want to help each other. I have a lot of writer friends and people that I meet over the internet. I explode this a bit, but I live in this godforsaken place where it's a long drive to anywhere where the big publishers go and where people go to parties to show themselves off to publishers. It's not my reality. I'm a mother and I don't go there. So for me, it's like the internet opened up. This sounds funny because the internet is not a new thing, but this people coming together over the internet and sharing their stories, and you can learn from my first book what I published and made every error you could. It's like just like the best learning you could ever do, and then some, I think. And then for my next novel, it's like I can ask all these people, I can get people interested in helping me to spread the word. There's a lot of community, I think, in this small world of Swedish self-publishing, and I think that is really the upside of us being
the small press has really been excellent at networking during the last couple of years. We're getting to know each other, and we are building something together which is stronger, meaner, and leaner than anything we could have done apart or as single entities. I do believe that especially when it comes to genre literature, there's never, ever in history been so much interesting stuff on the Swedish markets. I am not able anymore to read everything. Well, I am not even able to catch up on everything which comes out. So it's quite an exciting future, I believe, that we are going towards.
Yeah, that will sound really silly for the American, Oscar, that you as a person have actually been able to keep up with the things coming out from all markets. And that is how it's been. It's a small market, it's a small genre, but now it's like blooming. And I think it's really fun. And the collections and the anthologies actually bring a lot of attention to writers, because you can write a short story and you can get it in one of, like, Peter's collections, and you get bloggers and people noticing. And then when you come out with your own novel, then you have an upside I read your short story, and then maybe the novel is good as well, because reaching out and getting people to notice is always the hard step. Printing, writing is hard, but printing is easy. And then it gets hard again when you're supposed to get readers. So I think that's also changing.
When it comes to the big publishing houses, there are like two or three which are really big and hold a lot of the market here in the iron grip. I would say that most of them don't really know what's hitting them, really. They don't understand what's going on, except one of them, actually, which just recently released a beta of their own self-publishing platform. They want a piece of the action. They have studied their Darwin, and they know that they have to adapt in order to survive. I believe that in the future, that publishing house and the other one who actually adapts to the new markets, especially now before Amazon gets here, those who strengthen their network and strengthen their name on the markets will have a much better chance to actually survive when Amazon gets here. But a lot of the middle-sized publishers in between, I believe that we will see them wipe from the map, honestly, because they are not able to transform themselves fast enough into this new reality which the print-on-demand and ebook market has created.
I think the writers in general have this idea that they want their book to look and feel the way they want it to be. And the thing with self-publishing is that you are the boss. I just ask my editor, can I write this scene this way? Is it too strong? And the editor says, well, it's okay, because it's me. So it's it's not a problem. But I think with the smaller publishers, you won't, as a writer, see that this is something. They can't bring anything to the table. They can't do this billboard things. They can't put you on any shows. They can't make you reach out to any more readers. And they will have their ideas about how to do the book.
I don't believe that the big houses will ever go away entirely, though, because there is a lot of writers that do not feel comfortable with doing the covers and doing everything themselves. They like to just send in their manuscript and have something someone else do it for them.
Oscar, do we know? They are crazy people.
Well, you and me, Anna, we are perhaps more of the controlling type. I always hear people telling me these stories about how they have to handle their editor and how they have to handle their publishing house. And I always think, oh, thank God, I can hire whichever editor I want, and I can hire my own illustrator, and I hire my own graphical layout guy, and they do what I say.
It's hell what's going on, because you have to manage everything, but then when it comes out, it's yours. And all the blame and all the good things that people say, it's just yours. It's not, and if you reach some kind of reader, it's not because the big publishing house said this is what you're going to read, because that's the scene also, because it's so small and there's so few actors. If some of them say this is the new young adult book, and it's about witches, and this is what you're going to like, then I think it's somehow that happens. People like that book because it's the big publishers, and then they decide what people will like. But if you come from the underground, there's something alluring about that, that if you reach a reader when you come from nothing, then you know that it's not because some kind of a marketing scheme, it's because your writing is good enough. So I think it's more rewarding for me as a writer to know that I'm not a product of any big publishing house. I'm my own, and my writing is strong enough. If I reach a reader and she comes back to me and says, I liked your book, I really liked it, it made me feel this and this, then I know it's for real.
And how do your readers know how to find you? I mean, where do they find you? Through Twitter, Facebook?
Yeah. and also, I personally believe in being out there as much as possible, being out signing in food stores or wherever, really. I have sold so many books in ordinary food stores.
In food stores?
Yeah.
I mean, you just show up or you let them know you're coming?
No. Of course, I speak with the owner first, and they put my book in their system, and then we arrange a date, and we have some local advertisement in the paper, and often I manage to get an interview also in the paper, so people know that it's coming. And then they arrange a table, and I get there, and I usually stand somewhere between the bananas and the loaves of bread, and smile. I have my roll up with my books and a table in front of me with big stacks of books, and I just sell them like butter, and it's a wonderful feeling.
Wow, I can't imagine that happening here. That sounds, and is that in Stockholm, or is that more likely to happen in a smaller community?
Actually, I think it's likely to happen wherever. If you just contact your local store and ask them. I have been doing it for a couple of years now, and I know some other author friends who is doing it as well. Because there is something with people's mentality. When they walk into a bookstore, there are tens of thousands of different alternatives. When you walk into the food store looking for groceries, really, and suddenly there's a guy standing there with a really nice-looking book and talking to you, and you can get it signed and buy one for your kid, perhaps. There's something in your mind when you walk into a grocery store that you have already kind of like opened your wallet, so it's so easy to just get this book for your kid, put it in your shopping basket and move on, and then you pay for it with the other groceries in the cash registry, along with all the other stuff.
That's another upside with not living in New York. And even in Stockholm, everybody has a local grocery. It's not that big. So I think that people everywhere, I see it all the time. I haven't gone that far, actually. My local store is just a couple of it's not far from here, but it's a big step for me. I'm more of a, I like the libraries. I've sold a lot of books to libraries, and I like seeing that they get, people pick them up and read them there. So I think that maybe I do grocery stores for my next book. I'm a bit shy that way, but I think it's a good way. I think Oscar is right. When you're buying stuff, then you can buy a book. If you go into a bookstore, maybe you're just there to look, and it feels awkward with this guy standing there and wanting you to sign the book or anything. But in the grocery store, you're prepared to pay. So I think it's a good way.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And I also usually sell at markets. Well, we have these outside, what would you say?
Like a flea market?
Yeah, exactly. Like flea markets in downtown with tables everywhere. People selling everything from their own locally made honey to new wallets to, kind of like anything. And suddenly I stand there with my table and my books. And I also used to travel to different conferences. There is a pretty active Swedish fandom, and they have SweCon. We had Eurocon here a couple of years ago. 2012, was it? No, it was 2011. I don't remember anymore. Well,
it sounds great, and I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me, and everyone listening has heard it here first, that there is a new wave of Swedish science fiction writers out there, and listeners can dive in and get their first taste by looking at the collection or reading the collection, waiting for the machines to fall asleep. Yeah, so thanks so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's been an honor.
I've been talking with Anna Jakobsen-Lundt and Oskar Schellner, two contributors to the collection Waiting for the Machines to Fall Asleep. The book was edited by Peter Oberg, who I asked if he wanted to be on an interview, but he said he didn't feel so comfortable speaking. So if I had asked, if it had been in writing, he would have been fine with that. So maybe another day. I encourage listeners to check out other interviews with authors on the New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy website, www.newbooksinsciencefiction.com, and to subscribe on iTunes or other podcasting sites. We have a Facebook page. We tweet at New Books Sci-Fi. I tweet personally at Rob Wolf Books, and I've taken my own stab at self-publishing two YA science fiction books. And you can look me up at robwolf.net to find out more about that. Our logo is by Michael Thibodeau, theme music by Michael Aaron. The editor of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe. And in a couple weeks, I'll be talking to James Cambius about his book Corsair. And a couple weeks after that, I'll be talking to Melinda Snodgrass about Edge of Dawn, which is to be published in August. Bye for now. Thanks for listening.